You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm here today with John O'Brien and Evelyn Sullivan. John O'Brien edits the Dalkey Archive Press, a small but very important American press dedicated to the publishing of a certain kind of playful writing full of puzzles and games that some people might call obscure. One of the books he's recently published is Evelyn Sullivan's The Dead Magician. Evelyn's come down from Northern California, where she teaches at Stanford, and I thought we'd begin talking to her on this issue about the kind of literary puzzles that go on in the books. The Oulipo, for those who don't know, is a French school of writers who devise novels according to certain rules. Among the Oulipo writers are Raymond Queneau, but more famous to us, Italo Calvino. In America, we have Harry Matthews, who wrote Truth, The Conversions, The Sinking of the Odradek Stadium, and most recently, Cigarettes. I'd been having dinner with Harry, and I said, Harry, why won't you show us the internal plan of one of these books? If you truly want this kind of literary tradition to exist in America, the readers have to be courted. And after all, Nabokov did, in the British Penguin edition of Ada, include at the end of the book, by Vivian Darkbloom, an anagram of Vladimir Nabokov, he gave a list of trilingual puns, of secret references. He let the book open a bit to invite the readers in. He knew, perhaps, that it was to be his best book, and he was making a generous, uncharacteristic gift to readers. I guess in this century, this kind of thing begins with Joyce, with Finnegan's Wake, but why not an explanatory essay or even the examination of a particular sample corpse, just so we would see what these operations are like? Evelyn.
Well, I don't see anything intrinsically wrong with doing something like that. I don't think a writer has anything to lose in doing it. I haven't myself thought of such a project, but it seems to me dangerous on several levels, one of which has to do with the magic of the process. If you ask a stage magician about his tricks, he or she will never reveal them. For various reasons. One being that once you see the trick, you will say, ah, yes, well, if I just paid attention, I would have seen that, and the magic is gone.
It's interesting, because toward the end of The Dead Magician, the novel that Dalkey Archive just published by Evelyn E. Sullivan, there are truly uncanny happenings, disembodiments and, you know, continuous process is completed of knifing the heart, tearing at the heart, that has been a metaphor throughout the book. If these mysteries would in fact vanish upon explication of a technical sort.
Well,
go.
Yeah, but it seems to me that one other thing you do in providing such an explication is you eliminate the process of discovery for the reader who might read the book for the first or second or, God willing, third time and try to find the get at the heart of the secrets. And that seems to me something that is probably not a good idea to do. It also seems to me that there is a danger in destroying the magic, the sense of discovery, in cheapening the book in some way. And I have not given the matter thought. This is the first time anyone has asked me this question, so I would really have to sit down and seriously think about it, to what extent I would be willing to do something like that. Because you have, it's very flattering, perhaps the wrong word. I'm enormously pleased that you have recognized these patterns that are in the book that I deliberately put there. But I'd really have to think about whether I'd be willing to sit down and explain them to you and say, well, if you look at page 64, you will see this, and then if you go to page 316, you will discover the metaphor that relates to, you know, this sort of thing. I'd really have to think about whether I'd be willing to do that.
I guess it's a bookworm's disease, you know. I don't feel at rest with some of Harry Matthews's novels, although I like them, because I feel, gee, if he would only tell me what kind of trick I'm looking for. But there are not really indications. I guess he says that the puzzle generates the book. The book is not itself a puzzle. One is not meant to take it apart and discover the secret that brought it all into place. But I don't see how you can't think about that. Listeners to the bookworm are going to know my inevitable metaphor. It's like having a jigsaw puzzle that you're not allowed to see the pieces of. Clearly, the enjoyment is in discovering that texture and that structure. But sometimes there are books that I feel are almost like books that are waiting for their answer key. And knowing that the answer key will not be delivered in my own lifetime.
Except possibly by you, if you're sufficiently careful. That is always the hope one assumes that the author has, that the reader who is diligent and careful will discover these things. But it also seems to me that you're talking about one level of a book, and it would seem to me that a book would be a very poor work of art indeed if that were the only thing it were doing, if you were playing games and
I think if you have the sense that the book, whether it's conventional or unconventional novel, is hanging on a trick, which only if you could find out what that trick is, it would then be there for you. There are some novels that you do have that sense of the trick. Nicholas Mosley's Impossible Object, for instance, where you have story within story within story, and just as you get to that point where you feel as though you have him, that you have figured out which is the real story and which are the ones that have been generated by the real story, you then experience, no, this couldn't be possible, and then you get led right back into the book again. Now, it's not as though there's a key to that book, which, if only you could figure it out, the pleasure is that it doesn't exist, and the pleasure of the imagination is getting lost in that kind of labyrinth and along the way coming across all kinds of things. But I don't think that that's exclusive to fiction such as Harry Matthews. Evelyn and I were talking earlier about Hubert Selby's work, which would seem to be at the opposite end of the spectrum. And that's
Hubert
as mysterious
Selby.
As these works. And yet, there, if Selby were to step forward and say, the reason that my characters behave the way that they do is this, and this is the principle, I don't know how far we'd what he'd be telling us, that the pleasure of the book is, a large part of it is the mystery of it, which I think oftentimes eludes the writer as much as it does the reader.
Hubert Selby, the author of Last Exit to Brooklyn, lives here in Los Angeles and has been getting within this city just in the last 2 years some of the recognition that he's deserved for a long time. Also, I guess, the fact that a film is about to come out of Last Exit to Brooklyn is part of that gathering fame. But isn't it possible that sometimes the obscurity that we feel is unjust, in which often these writers tend to live, both in their private lives and in their literary life, books that are hard to find from small presses that are read only by initiates, mightn't all of that obscurity be the result of the kind of insistence of, there is a secret, but I won't tell you it, and a reader responding, well, if there is a secret and you won't tell me, I don't want to play. I sometimes think that, yes, sometimes these are taken to extremes. Nabokov's response to Mary McCarthy's famous articles on Pale Fire, for instance, points out that McCarthy may have gathered more mushrooms than there were planted in the growth. But
more
I
power to her.
Yes, I guess I'm just announcing my frustration. I want to be talking to a writer 24 hours a day, and that may be what the process of reading is about. But I always do like to think that if I met the writer, he or she would whisper secrets to me.
As I say, Michael, I think that if a book, and I certainly have read those kinds of novels, that you do have this knowing sense that there's a trick at work. And I feel as cheated by that kind of novel as, let's say, a conventional novel, which is going to turn on some kind of trick by, let's say, withholding certain information from the reader. So I don't think that's the problem. Imagine if Harry Matthews made the announcement of what the some of the formulas at work in those novels, who would be interested?
Well, you see, I think that these books contain secrets. If the secrets were revealed or selectively revealed, I would not feel that I loved the book less. I would feel that I loved the book more. I would go back to read it again and find, aha, ah, how ingenious. And also, I suspect that I would find the book more poetic rather than less. You see, I think that it is true that the books do not hang on these secrets, but that a reader may come to think, ah, this must be part of the secret code. I'll just read this very quickly. We all know books like Beckett's Watt, where there'll be page upon page of repetition that the reader skis over. I love every single one. I guess my eye wants to go through every permutation and trick and bit of spontaneity that Beckett embeds in the text. But I would love to be somehow invited into the inner circle, and I know as an undergraduate, as a student of literature, it was that led me into more deeply to penetrate the forest. Can you comment a bit about this, Evelyn, in any way?
Well, I wonder how detailed you'd like your explanation to be. That would be my first question. I mean, obviously a writer could tell you things like the aboutness of the novel, what is it really about, or what is it really about, and I could tell you things like, well, this novel is about mortality, it is about resurrection, and that might be enough of a hint for you to sit down, reread it, or read it for the first time and say, ah, now it's beginning to make sense, or I see the relationships. Would that be enough for you, or would you want me to really sit down and say, all right, look on page 102, and you will find this reference, and then if you... I mean, it becomes very difficult for me to say how much I would have to tell you that would satisfy you, or any given reader.
I could tell that The Dead Magician by Evelyn Sullivan, recently published by Dalkey Archive Press, whose editor is also with us, John O'Brien, I could tell that The Dead Magician was about mortality and resurrection. That is the kind of thing you do know being a reader of a book. The book demands first a good reader, but then I suppose I want the reward pettifors of having certain backwoods tricks explained.
Uh-huh.
This is all, I know, a very, perhaps for the listener, arcane part of writing, but it is thrilling. What are the tricks that the writer uses? It's not all memory. It's never the creative journal. That's the thing, in many cases, that the writer is fleeing from. I want to thank Evelyn Sullivan and John O'Brien for coming and talking a bit about these additional secrets as they are manifested in the books from the Dalkey Archive Press, and in particular in the book The Dead Magician, the novel by Evelyn Sullivan. Thank you, John and Evelyn. My second guest today is Gilbert Sorrentino, who has just completed a trilogy of novels. The first volume
was called Odd Number. The second volume, Rose Theater. The third volume, Mysterioso, has just come out from Surprise, the Dalkey Archive Press. We've been talking about hidden structures in literature, and if anything is going to be found in these books, hidden and otherwise, it's structure. These are books that are almost all shape. What do you have to say about that, Gilbert Sorrentino?
That's very true, Michael, indeed. The way I write usually is I very rarely start with anything so tangible as content in mind. What I try to do is set up a structure for myself, which I then try to complete or affect in the work itself. And when the structure is completed to my satisfaction, I have, so to speak, a content. The form, in a sense, makes the content occur. The form, in a sense, is the generative device whereby my content appears. It sounds like an odd way to do it, I'm sure, but I've always believed, in a sense, that there's very little separation, if any, between form and content, and I've discovered over the many years that I've been writing that form is something that always generates content.
I want to start, really, by talking about the kind of fiction you are turning your back on. Could you define what you call the New Yorker story?
Well, the problem with the New Yorker story is that it's too well written. What I mean by that is there's very little surprise in a New Yorker story, because what happens in a New Yorker story is that conventionalized responses are asked for by conventionalized tropes. By that I mean a New Yorker story is rarely surprising, in that what a New Yorker story tries to do is effect a kind of transcendence within the context of the story, which allows the reader to feel as if he has learned something true or something definitive about life. And I don't believe, really, that there's anything definitive about life whatsoever.
In the course of one of the essays in Something Said, your book of literary criticism and observations, you say of John Hawkes that you feel The Blood Oranges is a book that the man on the bus could read with enjoyment if he weren't being stifled by the threatening fiction he's being offered. Do you still feel that way, and about the books that you're writing now?
Well, I really do. Oddly enough, I have perhaps a skewed opinion of this, although I suspect that other writers perhaps share it with me. My sense of this is that the audience for the kinds of books that I write are of needs highly educated. The problem is that highly educated audiences bring to the texts that they confront all their education, which means their education is mediating between them and the text, and if they see something in the text that it is, in a sense, against the grain of their education, they set up an enormous resistance to it. Oddly enough, I feel that my true audience, if there is such a thing, is, in a sense, an audience that would never read my books. But I think that they probably could read my books. I use an analogy sometimes here at Stanford when I teach, and I say, if you've ever read a book to a child, you realize that a child never questions the structures or the odd things that occur in any child's book. What they're interested in is literally what happens. They're never bewildered by these things. They simply accept them as part of the reality of the fiction that's being read them. They have very little mediating capabilities, which makes them great readers.
I love these three books, the Mysterioso, Odd Number, and Rose Theater. Mysterioso, the most recent, and from Dalkey Archive Press. But I have no idea of how to even begin to describe them. Who evolves this jacket copy?
For Mysterioso?
Uh-huh.
That was my idea. That was my idea. That's the double seal of Solomon, which is a magical inscription that necromancers used to use in, as they say, white magic rather than black magic. And in a sense, I think it perhaps cuts into the center of the book, because my books are filled with the demons of necrology and the demons of necromancy, I should say. But all of them are sort of stumblebum demons. They don't really get the job done very well.
Well, it seems as if, you know, sent to scourge the earth of all of its pestilence, which in these cases, these three novels, include literary people who seem to be also forgers, betrayers, thieves, and fools. That nevertheless, all of these demons en masse can't do the job. Is that because the demons have become weak or evil on Earth has become too strong?
I think the Earth has become too strong for them. Apparently they're co-opted as soon as they get here.
How would you describe the trio, this trilogy now completed?
The best way to do it would be to begin, I suppose, with Odd Number. My sense of Odd Number, or my sense of the trilogy, is simply based on the idea of what one might call gossip, second-hand and third-hand information, or information which is given to you, which you then pass on to someone else. Information that cannot in any sense be verified. My sense of this in fiction, as well really as in life, is that one of the great problems with gossip, one of the great problems with tall tales, one of the great problems with outright lies, is that even if the lie or the gossip is later rectified, one discovers, so to speak, the truth or the facts. The gossip which has originally been posited never disappears.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, in terms of, let's say, the inscribed text, the gossip is just as real as the facts. Well, in Odd Number, what I do is simply push that about as far as I can push it, so there's absolutely no sense at the end of Odd Number of what, as they say, really happened to anybody, and there's very little sense, ultimately, of who anybody really is.
It's an absolutely hilarious book, and by the end of it, many of the characters are going by one another's names.
Oh, yes, right. They take on each other's names and sometimes take on each other's personalities. The problem is you don't know if they're real names or not, because what you've got is three voices are telling you supposedly the truth in the book, and each voice contradicts each other voice. So ultimately you can't tell which voice is telling you the truth about which people.
This is, despite all, a detective story.
Oh, yeah, exactly. In other words, this is a detective story, except not only don't you know who done it, you don't know what was done. That's really what happens.
And then Rose Theater.
Rose Theater is really a kind of reprise of what happens or what might have happened to all the women in Odd Number. Rose Theater has only to do, especially, with the women in Odd Number. And what I did there was structure Odd Number around many of the props that were used in the old English Rose Theater. Philip Henslow, who was the director of the Rose Theater, kept a remarkable diary in which he kept meticulous records of all of the props that he owned. And what I did was select a list of his props, which seemed to me evocative of what I wanted to do. In other words, I would take a prop, let's say, beacon or chain of dragons, and I would allow myself to consider what might a chain of dragons be in my text. In other words, in the context of my people and their adventures, how could I make a new chain of dragons? How could I make this prop work in terms of my context?
Oh, so it is once again too a list.
It's a list.
It's an inventory.
It's an inventory of props.
And then Misterioso.
Misterioso is an upsettery. What I did to write Misterioso was to go through both Odd Number and Rose Theater and make a list of all of the proper nouns in the book. People, places, things, titles of books, titles of pictures, titles of pieces of music and what have you. And then alphabetize within the alphabetical list until I had a list of common nouns of, I guess, so probably had 1,200 or 1,500 proper nouns, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started with the very first proper noun, linked it to the next proper noun, and made a sentence of that. In other words, these nouns were thrown together arbitrarily by means of the alphabet, and my fiction arose from the linking together of the nouns. That's how the book was written. It sounds rather odd, I suppose, but it's really a basic generative device to use the alphabet as to generate content. It was very odd writing it, because each day when I sat down to write, I would look at the nouns that I had got up to, and I would, let's say, glance down the list, and I'd see five or six nouns, none of which had anything to do with each other. So my task was to make them have something to do with each other. So that's how Mysterioso was written.
Now, you talk about, in a recent essay on fiction, about Raymond Roussel and how this fiction really is the fiction of inertia and death. Is the book Mysterioso, would seem to be a death notice for a dead or such a vilified culture that it can't be anything but inventoried and alphabetized, correct, or somewhere near?
I think that's a fair way of putting it, yes. I think one of the problems with our culture is that the writer's task is complicated so terribly by this culture, not so much because, as Philip Roth said years ago, it's impossible to parody or satirize a culture which is its own parody or its own satire. I think the problem is that the language has somehow been so completely taken over by, as it were, the machinery of, let's say, corporate capitalism or the machinery of big unions or the machinery of, let's say, a vast and overpowering entertainment industry. The writer must somehow get in between the little interstices in this officialized language and try to write out of those little slots in which he can still breathe. And I think to use an alphabet is, in a sense, trying to... It's negating the idea of what Roland Barthes called the glamorous combining of predicates, which is sort of like, you know, what good writing is. How to write well is to combine predicates. Well, my idea is not to write well, but to try to say something true, if you will. And by true, I don't mean true in let's say, the normative sense.
Or the New Yorker sense.
I'm trying to say something that... The point is, the problem with the New Yorker is I always get annoyed with the New Yorker, and the New Yorker, let's call that... It's a genre story. I mean, lots of magazines are guilty of publishing this kind of story. The problem is that the writers who write those stories always annoy me because they take this position in which they supposedly have the answers. They know everything. Well, I don't know everything. I mean, I know very little. And my point is to try to write a book which is true to its own structure. If a writer can only really lie in terms of his form, he can't really lie any other way. I'm trying to make a clean form.
In this trilogy, Odd Number, Rose Theater, and Mysterioso, it's not a matter of an author knowing everything. It's can an author or anyone know anything? I've been talking to Gilbert Sorrentino, whose most recent book, Mysterioso, has been published by the Dalkey Archive Press. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. Thank you, Mr. Sorrentino, for being with us by phone. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.